So from 1970, the establishment of his tomb, in just 10 years' time, 1980, which sounds to me kind of quick, really, given the slow-turning wheels of the federal government, was there any opposition to creating this district?
There was suspicion from a variety of quarters. There was suspicion among African-American activists as to whether the federal government could actually tell the story fully about King, in particular whether the federal government would include treatment of the federal surveillance of Martin Luther King, among other factors. So there was suspicion as to whether the federal government could actually tell the story well.
The district includes close to 40 acres, if I'm not mistaken. And I think the original idea was to, well, obviously, not just to preserve the church, Ebenezer Baptist Church, and his birth home, but they wanted to preserve the entire neighborhood.
Right. This is the neighborhood where Martin Luther King was born, where he lived, where he preached and worked, and where he was buried. So at some level, the original intent was to situate King within this geography of Auburn Avenue, which in its heyday was a thriving thoroughfare, kind of the hub of African-American social life and commerce through much of 20th century Atlanta. Auburn Avenue had fallen on kind of hard times after the 1960s and 1970s. You had African migration to the west side of town. You had the interstate highway system, which bisected Auburn Avenue. You had, after desegregation, employment opportunities opening up for African-Americans elsewhere as well. So at some level, Auburn Avenue had gone into decline. So it's sort of interesting to place this National Historic Site in the midst of what was then a declining neighborhood.
When Martin Luther King Jr. was growing up, the Sweet Auburn district was thriving.
That's right. There was an array of black-owned businesses, other black-owned institutions, churches, insurance companies, the Atlanta Daily World, the first African-American daily newspaper was on Auburn Avenue, Masonic lodges, a vibrant array of interlocking black community institutions.
That economic success, albeit segregated from the larger white community in Atlanta, what impact do you think it had on King's vision and on his attitude toward life?
Well, he grew up in a very secure environment. You know, his family was secure. He grew up in a very kind of stable kind of community. Not to say that there weren't divisions with that in that community, but basically sort of, by and large, a nurturing environment. And he also had his role models, leaders of that community, too. Down the street from where the King family lived was C.L. Harper, who was principal of Booker T. Washington High School and leader in the NAACP. So there are role models both within his own family and in the larger community around him.
So once the district is outlined and established by Congress in 1980, how did things progress after that?
Kind of pokes along for a long time. I mean, yes, Congress had authorized the district, but they hadn't allocated very many funds for it. And there was a small staff. The activities were largely tours of the birth home and the church. There was a community center there. Then after Atlanta got the Olympic bid, the Park Service kind of recognized this was an opportunity to lobby for funds. And in particular, they realized, as did others in Atlanta, that the world was coming to Atlanta, and a lot of the world wanted to see sites associated with Dr. Martin Luther King. And if the facilities were kind of dilapidated and substandard, that would leave a bad mark. And so there's this sort of branding going on by city officials and city leaders to kind of brand Atlanta as this kind of progressive city, the birthplace of Martin Luther King. Yet visitors would come and they wouldn't see very much. So that was one of the impetuses for this upgrading of the visitor center. The park took over the historic Ebenezer Church and helped build a new Ebenezer Church right across the street. So it's sort of interesting to think of a government agency doing this kind of stuff. The next thing I think that's really important in the development is the staging of the Without Sanctuary exhibit in 2002, the lynching photograph exhibit. Up to that point, you know, they had by and large portrayed the story largely that of one of King and the 39 years that he lived and the geographic area surrounding the birth home and along the King District. And they hosted this very controversial exhibit on lynching photographs, and it kind of marked a departure to kind of tell King's story within a larger context of African-American, American, and even world history. So subsequently, they've had exhibits on the gulags of the Soviet Union, and they had an exhibit on the 1906 race riot. In other words, placing the story well beyond Martin Luther King alone to kind of include him within much larger stories that extend even beyond American borders.
The King Center for Nonviolent Social Change is included within the district, but it's still maintained by the King family. And, well, as we know, several years ago, the King family came under a lot of criticism for allowing the center to fall into a sort of state of disrepair. How has that connection worked out between the federal government maintaining the historic district and the King family maintaining the King Center?
Right. You have two entities actually involved in kind of disseminating, if you will, the legacy of Martin Luther King on the same block, one connected with the King family, one connected with the federal government. And to be frank, without going into too many details, the relationship hasn't always been the warmest. In 1996, when the National Park succeeded in getting a significant congressional allocation to build a new visitor center and upgrade the national park facilities on site, basically, to make a long story short, a deal had to kind of be brokered between the Martin Luther King Center and the Martin Luther King National Historic Site, which really are two different entities. You know, there's talk about whether at some point the park might take over the center's physical facility, which is experiencing some problems right now. You know, and I can't speculate as to when or how that might happen, but that might well happen down the road.
And there is talk about preserving the rest of Auburn Avenue.
Well, now you have the proposed streetcar.
Right.
And at some level, that's a continuation of this story in that the streetcar is going to run down Auburn Avenue to the forthcoming Center for Civil and Human Rights at the north end of Centennial Olympic Park. And so the idea is that perhaps tourists could kind of take the streetcar to both venues and see the King District as well as the center.
And what's the future hold? What are the plans for tomorrow and beyond?
That's a good question. They have recently renovated the historic Ebenezer Church to the way that it looked when King was a child. And it was a major undertaking involving millions of dollars. But if you go there, you can see how it actually was when he was a child. There's a new mural that's right across the street from the visitor center that's a marvelous display of a King by a local artist, Louis Del Sarte. Hard to say where they go down the road. They still draw large numbers of people come to the King site every year. But, of course, we're living in more attenuated times financially.
Well, Cliff Kuhn, thank you.
Thank you.